My name is Joe Delaney. I lived on Lancaster West Estate, which was attached to Grenfell Tower until 2022. Before the fire, I was involved in the Grenfell Action Group, which handled the blog that famously predicted the fire in its November 2016 piece, Playing with Fire, written by Francis O'Connor. So I was with the Grenfell Action Group before the fire, and since the fire, I've worked with Justice for Grenfell to try and get some accountability for what happened that night. You know, maybe see a few people see inside a prison cell, ideally.
Well, I think that's, you know, that's what obviously should happen. You mentioned this prediction. Well, let me just quote from that blog. It's our conviction, and this was, I think, between 6 and 10 months before Grenfell Tower fire. It's our conviction that a serious fire in a tower block or similar high-density residential property is the most likely reason those who wield power at the KCTMO, that's the management organisation for Grenfell, will be found out and brought to justice. So this is an incredible prediction, really, and it seems that nobody was listening, Joe.
Nope. The only time we had a council that listened, sadly, was the fire was the 14th of June 2017. The only time we had a council that listened was the 15th of June 2017, when they thought they'd go to prison. Then they were actually quite a responsive council. I remember in the first scrutiny committee meeting that there was, the Grenfell scrutiny committee they set up, which again they only set up because they thought they were going to prison and they needed to look like they were, you know, actually responding to residents. One of the councillors, the lead for housing, Tim Taylor Smith, or Taylor Swift as I call him, did the song and dance and makes of everything. He said, like, he was like, you know, when I checked on the morning after the fire with this TMO, they had 27,000 outstanding repairs. Isn't that disgraceful? And I said to him, yeah, councillor, you're right, it is disgraceful. Did those repairs all come in on that morning on the 15th of June? Did they, or did you ignore them systematically leading up to the 14th of June when the fire was? And now you think it's a disgrace? No, you haven't had to live in these properties. You haven't had to live with these issues. But it's a disgrace now that it's brought to your attention. Why wasn't it brought to your attention beforehand if you're saying you didn't know it? And if you didn't know it, how the hell were you auditing that organisation? You know, and as usual, you just get looked at like you're the problem at that point. Why, look, we're doing something now. Why is he still getting uppity?
Yeah, you know, in John Snow, Channel 4 News' interview with Eddie Dufan, if that's the correct pronunciation, Eddie explains that they felt like, the residents in the tower felt like this was something which was just simply being done to them, and that there was a value in the land, and the idea was that the management organisation was sweating the asset, in other words, trying to get as much money out of it as possible, so that the whole thing would not collapse, but fall apart, people might move out, the place might be condemned, so it could be redeveloped and speculators could move in.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long-term plan they have around here. If you look, they had a borough plan that was published just before the fire. They revised it once again in 2016. The planning document for the borough. And they said on that they wanted to restore the original street base that had been around here prior to the arrival of the A40 Westway flyover. And unfortunately for Grenfell Tower, it's smack in the middle of one of those old roadways. You see, and that's why I've got issues now with what they've said about the memorial. Because they're now, they've said that the government made this decision. The government have been in power for, 6 months, roughly, this new government. What are they doing? They're relying on the advice of officials. It's the same officials who gave advice that led to the fire, who are now advising on what to do after the fire. And, like, this is what none of the politicians seem to get. And Lorraine is like, I'm just going on the advice. And it's like, yeah, but the advice is biased. You know, oh, well, these are the designs that the Memorial Commission came up with. Yeah, but the Memorial Commission was only allowed to commission these designers who don't do anything high-rise. You know, now, I get, with that tower, I get that, like, all of it can't be salvaged. It is a dangerous thing. I mean, you walk past it when it's windy, you can hear it. It is terrifying. You know, and that was why I had to move eventually in 2010. It was cracking me up, being under this thing. It really was cracking me up. So I get that it needs to go, but it can be preserved up to the 10th floor. And, like, there's no good idea about what to do for a memorial in that area, but there's a least worst idea. And the least worst one is, you know, you preserve it as the gravesite, as the tomb, effectively, that it is as much as possible for the people who died.
Yeah, because there is a worry that when it's demolished, that it will just be some sort of luxury place put up, which is what they wanted all along, and which is why it happened.
This is the thing. Across the road from Grenfell Tower, there's the Lancaster Road Methodist Church. And just behind the Methodist Church, there's a little housing development there. So it's a square with houses around it. And there's a gap in that in the square of houses. On one side, one row of them, there's missing a house. You can see, like, there's a row of them, then it stops, and then there's a row continuing. And there's no indication why this one little plot of land wasn't built on. And as I say, it's within 200 metres of the tower. And the reason it wasn't built on was it was where 10 Rillington Place was. If you remember, that was John Christie's house, the guy who murdered loads of people and blamed the neighbour, Timothy Evans, who got hung for it. He was the last person to be hung in the UK, and it led to the abolition of corporal punishment. Capital punishment. Yeah, I'm thinking.
Just hang on, let's just leave a little gap there so I can find that and edit it. Yeah.
But yes. That was the reason that the UK got rid of capital punishment in this country, because of that miscarriage of justice that happened. The man was tried for murdering his wife and child. He was convicted of murdering the child, and was hung within 2 years. And then it was a year after that that someone else moved into a flat that was in this house. But it was a house that was three flats, one on each floor. And someone else moved into one, and they were doing renovations. They knocked through a wall, and they found 8 bodies that this guy had hidden there. And then, of course, the truth came out. And it was a huge scandal at the time. And there's a famous incident that happened in it with the Home Secretary under the Labour government that came in 1964. Sir Frank Soskis, his name was. He refused to accept a petition that had been started a year before by the opposition, shadow Home Secretary, to get a pardon for this Timothy Evans chap. And then, so Sir Frank Soskis refused it, and it ended Sir Frank Soskis's career. And the reason it ended it was he had been in opposition the year before. He was the one who started the petition. And yet, in the interim, there'd been a change of government, so he was now the Home Secretary who could receive the petition. So that shows you how good civil service house training is of politicians.
Yeah, well, I mean, what it suggests is you've got a lot of these officials who are supposed to be, we're paying their wages, they're supposed to be there to administrate a safe nation for us, but actually they seem to be, in many ways, a bunch of cowardly blockheads.
Yeah, I mean, there's a great line in Yes, Prime Minister about that. Bernard Woolley says to Sir Humphrey, he's like, well, I mean, shouldn't the people get to decide what happens? Isn't this a democracy? And Sir Humphrey just says to him, this is a British democracy, Bernard. Like that, and I think that tells you all you need to know. You know, but the fact that they could train a civil servant could train an MP that well. He starts the petition in 1963. In 1964, he becomes Home Secretary. The petition comes to him to accept, and he refuses it. He refused his own petition. There's an episode of Yes Minister where they do the same thing. As a joke, where Jim Hacker turns down his petition against illegal bugging and wiretapping of people when he finds out that they were doing it to an MP. And then by that point, he's become the minister, and so he has to refuse his own petition. You see, it was based on a true story. It was Sir Frank Soskis. And this is why I find it funny that Angela Rayner has done the same thing now. You know, they're all saying that they get and understand, you know, what the importance that Grenfell represents and how it should be a watershed and everything. But they're still allowing Kensington and Chelsea to do exactly what it wanted to do. It's going to be a lot easier for them to move some hideous bronze sculpture or whatever other kind of monstrosity is placed in that area.
I mean, it does look as if they're still shying away from the idea of actually arresting people and putting individuals on trial. I mean, the announcement...
There have been arrests.
Right. Any trials?
The arrests were members of the community, Tony. They're the only arrests that there have been. Two members of our community have been in prison for grand theft. Not anyone who was responsible for it. The two people who were done around here were basically done on public order offences when they took issue with something that happened around the tower. One, I think, was where basically the covers that they wrapped around it kept coming off, and he went and shouted at one of the manager of the site. And the council insisted on prosecuting this as harassment, ironically. And even the chap himself, who'd been like the victim of this attack, a so-called attack, didn't want it prosecuted. And he said so in court at the time, but the council just pushed on with it. You know, the other person who's been done was a person who was evacuated after the fire. She went to the hotel because she couldn't live. She was on Grenfell Walk. They evacuated her. And her son was living with his girlfriend at the time in some coastal town. I can't remember which one. But he got attacked down there by some guys, like who had some issue with him and the girlfriend for something. And he got quite bad at the time. And so he came back to live with his mum. And now, if she'd still been on Grenfell, he would have just moved into the flat there. But she wasn't. She was in a hotel, so he had to move in there with her. And then the council like, right, now it comes to rehoming people. So they were offering him a flat as well because he'd moved back with his mum. And then they tried to say, oh, but he wasn't living there before the fire. This is fraud. And they prosecuted her and she went to prison.
Good God. Well, I heard from Angela Rayner is 7 organisations have been criticised and could be banned from bidding for public contracts, the government said. Well, they're not saying they are banned, they might be banned.
No, exactly.
We already know. I don't know why we need to have these sorts of long drawn out investigations. We already know that, Rock Fielding Mellon at Kingston and Chelsea Council was the person responsible for introducing the flammable cladding into the contract to refurbish Grenfell. We also know about a company, I think, called Harley Facades that was building and making this...
Sellotex knew that their stuff was dangerous, and yet they decided...
It should be obvious to any manufacturer of cladding that it cannot and must not ever be flammable. Flammable cladding, it should not be a thing. And, you know, and so why were these people... Do you think even making this stuff?
They were making it because it was cheap. They were making it because, you know, it fulfilled the latest, you know, the latest fashionable criteria that needed to be done. We're at the end of February now. Right, when will it be? It will be 5 months' time. So yeah, July, August. We always get this performative thing from the police around here. Just before Notting Hill Carnival, they will raid some weed dealer. You know, some small-time weed dealer who sells a bit of pot to his neighbours. They'll raid him, and it'll be a massive dawn raid, and there'll be loads of them that go in and everything. And then they'll say, look, we've cleaned up London now before Carnival. You know, because at that time of the year, for the police, those targets are the ones that are favourable. Unfortunately, when all of these regenerations were being decided, the main metric was insulation. You know, what's the environmental rating going to be after we do this work? Like, what is it now and what will it be afterwards? And so that was all they were scoring on, basically, was how much heat this thing could keep in, ironically. Because by the end of it, it proved to keep in one hell of a lot of heat, didn't it? Given the fact that it burns hotter than a crematorium.
Frightening. There is the organisation justiceforgrenfell.org. Yeah. It is, you'll find it online, who have criticised this government announcement, saying really that they want actual change to make sure a fire like Grenfell never happens again in this, I think, rather nice sort of solidarity across London and across the country, saying it's not just about our situation, it's about the state of the nation that can allow something like this to go unpunished. They're talking also about financial penalties for people who violate safety standards. The process is being transparent because, as one of your Justice for Grenfell colleagues pointed out, the freedom of information requests that they put in about the contracts had been answered, then the fire may well never have happened because it would have been transparent. These were deemed to be commercially confidential. And also, of course, regulation where tenants are not only involved, even on periphery, but actually it's led by tenants. So what do you make of trying to sort of see through this and look at the possibility of some meaningful changes that make sure that something like this can't ever happen?
Well, I mean, this is it. Like they're saying now there'll be a single regulator for construction. You know, I thought that we had that already in the shape of the Health and Safety Executive. I would have thought that would have been the one that had the final oversight on everything. There's not even been health and safety prosecutions for Grenfell up to now. And that's what I find the most disgraceful about this. You don't need that. They all got immunity to agree to testify at the inquiry. All the good it did. But they were given immunity nonetheless. But we don't need them to testify. These crimes are in black and white. There are emails on the public record, on the inquiry website, that show, you know, members of staff of different organisations discussing about which services was the best one to use along the M1 in terms of internet connection. So that, you know, and to bring, if they're bringing the money, cash, the bribing cash, could they please ensure that they don't bring £50 notes, as the recipient felt like a drug dealer whenever they tried to spend them. You know, it's on record that they decide that they forged documents to make it look like the aluminium cladding was cheaper than the zinc cladding because they had a job lot of the aluminium they wanted to get rid of. So ironically, the zinc lining for that cladding would have been cheaper and that would have, you know, been more fire resistant than the stuff that they put up. But the company just happened to have a load of aluminium it wanted to sell. So you know what? Screw them. Everyone was like, they all made one decision where they thought, nothing's going to go wrong if I just break this rule. You know, but the system now is so fragile and there are so few redundancies built into it that if more than one area does that at the same time, the whole thing collapses because it's all just so flimsy. You know, it's put together with sellotape, you know, rubber glue and good wishes, basically. That's it. It's what's cheapest, what looks the best, and that's it. And where I said that Rillington Place was 200 metres away from the tower, less than that, about 50 metres from the tower, was a councillor's home. And it's quite a posh house. It's a three-floor house. And he owns all of it, because there's only one doorbell. So you know it's all his. And it's come out in a lot of the paperwork that they were saying that after they built the academy and school, the tower would be the poorer cousin of these two new buildings. And I know exactly who said that. It was the guy who you mentioned earlier, Rockfield in Mellon, because it's his house. And I can imagine it. He used to get up in his crypt, or whatever room it was, he slept in his house, you know, when he opened his coffin in the morning and got out and looked out the window, the first thing he'd see was that tower. And he's sort of old money. So you know that things like poorer cousin, that's always knocked about at their dining tables. You know, and I mean, his family are bizarrely, sort of, yeah, they're a bizarre outfit is all I can say. Well, Fielding Mellon wrote a piece for Newsweek last year. And basically the gist of the piece is, I killed people at Grenfell. However, people were really mean to me because I killed people at Grenfell, and that made me feel sad. And then I got depressed from feeling sad. And then I went to stay with Mummy, and I took psychedelics on Mummy's farm because Mummy's growing them for the medical industry. So look, I feel great now, and it doesn't bother me anymore that people were mean to me about me killing people at Grenfell. So look, I feel great, and you should try these mushrooms too. It's a 4-page advertorial written by a psychopath. It's the only description I could give them.
I mean, we don't seem to be approaching any sort of justice, Joe, really, in terms of people. I mean, it's just a cover-up. You know, you can think of things like Hillsborough, this sort of thing. Is there any sort of... this must actually kind of encourage a wish for somebody to actually do something, even if it's someone from abroad, vigilantes, or anything.
Luigi Mangione seems to have had the right idea. And just look at the way the media have treated him. You see, the unfortunate thing for them in his case is that the chap happens to be very good looking. You know, so they can't even do the usual thing.
So what's happened there? Sorry, I don't know.
Luigi Mangione was the guy who shot dead the head of one of the health insurance companies in the US. He shot him dead when he was on his way to an investor meeting. I think it was Southern Cross Healthcare or something like that. It's the biggest provider of health insurance in the US. And it turns down 85% of claims made. On average, I think that on the first hurdle, everyone will be told no, like 85 times out of 100. And yeah, he just went and executed the guy. And then there was a manhunt for him. But the problem was, they realized in the US, there's no jury is going to convict this man. No jury will convict him anyway. That they would just immediately have jury nullification. In each case, they'd be like, yeah, he's guilty, but we don't think he should be punished. And so they've now upped the charge against him for murder. It was going to be murder in New York State, because it was New York City where he did it. And it's been upped from murder to terrorism, because terrorism is a federal offence, and you can be tried without jury. And there's been a complete media blackout about this. It was reported when he was shot dead. And when he was on the run, but the moment they caught him, it was like you could see they were absolutely trying to make this guy look horrible in every way they could. But unfortunately, he just looks like a model in all of the shots that they drew of him. So it just makes him look even more glamorous the whole time. So they've just stopped reporting on the matter entirely.
I mean, 72 people killed, obvious implications of, at the very least, corporate manslaughter. Nobody punished. I mean, this is starting to look like, you've almost, I mean, you've got, we had this week thousands of carers marching in central London saying, why are you forcing our employers to pay more national insurance? It's already on its knees, the whole elderly care industry. We've got thousands of farmers who are coming into central London saying, why are you destroying our ability to grow food? I mean, it seems that this government actually has it in for its own population, Joe.
The thing in this country is, like, people are saying, that people are apathetic about stuff. And that's why this Luigi Mangione case is quite interesting, because he's got a support across the political spectrum. There isn't a family, one commentator said of it, there isn't a family in the US that doesn't know someone who hasn't been screwed over by our healthcare system. You know, there isn't a family in this country that doesn't know someone who has died prematurely because of decisions that were made by health insurance companies. It's something that crosses the political spectrum. You know, and things like, where you see that everyone, regardless, rich, poor, young, old, people need care all the time throughout their lives. And the Labour Party back in the 40s, when they were setting up the NHS, it was just an oversight at the time that home care wasn't rolled in to this service and it was left with local authorities. I think at the time it was done for logistical reasons. It was like, this infrastructure's already in place and we're already having to stuff the mouths of all the doctors with gold to shut them up in order to get them to agree to allow us to set up the NHS. So it was a fight we don't need at the moment. We'll come back to it. And they never have. And consistently since then, what NHS services we have are just eroded away. You know, you lost eyesight, eye care, then you lost dental care. You know, now what little home care there is being taken away as well. And it disproportionately affects the poor, but it is something where there is broad support. And yet still it is not done. Because it seems that all the politicians, regardless of what party they're in, don't want to raise taxes on the rich. And that's the problem. That's inequality is the biggest problem that we have facing us. You know, you look at even the reports from things like Kinsey, and company, you know, the consultants, the real evil consultants, the ones I could advise on how to get people hooked to oxycodone and all the other opiate prescription painkillers in the US. Like, they actually came up with a business plan on how you would get people hooked on these long term so that you'd have repeat custom. Like, they're that ruthless. Even they are saying that inequality is a problem. Now, you know, even when the sort of, you know, the physical embodiment of capitalism is telling you that capitalism is going too far. Do you think maybe we should take our foot off the accelerator for a while? And it seems the only people who don't get this are our leaders.
Well, our media as well, I think a mass media is also in the universities. There's a sort of elite institutions that don't really seem to want to move. They'd much rather stay in their own place, in their own position.
Where you mentioned mass media, there's an interesting story for you. I worked in Parliament for Emma Jane Coe when she was MP for Kensington. I was there in 2018 and 19, up till lockdown, basically. And I remember I was speaking with a couple of Labour MPs at the time, and these were quite senior ones. And I mentioned to them the local democracy fund. Now, if you don't know what that is, it's basically where a portion of the BBC licence fee is sliced off and is supposedly meant to be seeded in order to encourage local democracy reporting, because there's been a complete absence of that in recent years. There's no real local news structures in the way they used to be. There's no real national ones either. Now, you know, they all tend to just buy stories off the press association. And so you'll get variants on a story as opposed to having different journalists there giving you the story. And so that's what this was meant to do. This money is like that. And this is millions of pounds, because a local democracy reporter was assigned to every borough, every council in the country. So there's loads of them out there. But the problem is this money was given to Reach PLC, you know, who are owners of the Daily Express, amongst others. And so it's basically like public money is being given to media sort of oligarchs to continue to spread their political message around this country. Yeah, and it's absolutely ridiculous that my license money is being used in that fashion. Whatever problems there may be with the BBC, it's like, at least I understand it's ad-free and, you know, it's meant to do these things. I get that. I can support it going to that. But for it to be given to something like the Daily Express, I wouldn't buy that paper. I wouldn't read that if it was there for free. And yet they are getting a significant portion of our license fee to provide us with local democracy reporting. And they're not doing it. Because I know the local democracy reporter who used to be in Kensington. She had to leave. She couldn't take it here anymore because of the pressure she was getting from doing Grenfell stories. But her editor was basically saying to her, you know, you need to get out and find cute cats and things like that because they're the ones that get the hits. She won Local Democracy Reporter of the Year 1 year. She came second in that 1 year for a story that she'd done on Grenfell. And yet still she was pressured by her boss to come up with
stuff. I think this is something that maybe the viewers and the listeners and the readers don't realise is the extent to which there is a mass and organised harassment of journalists who are trying to do the right thing. And often they can research and write a story that never makes it into print. And also lose their jobs, lose their careers, have contracts not renewed, because there is there are systems out there by putting pliable people onto boards, also people who are connected through marriage or whatever to, say, a local authority, big business locally, so that when it looks like a story might be about to emerge, that pressure is put on. And that's why there are a few of us freelancers left that don't have to worry about that sort of thing. But the question is, how do you get that news out? Anyway, Joe,
to give you a very good example, in this area, there has been an increase in the number of suicides since the fire. But there has been a substantial increase. Like, the incidents are way, like, there's way more around here than there should be. When you take everything else in, and you take all the other weightings into account, there is still an anomalous amount around here. I mean, suicides have gone up, unfortunately, as austerity has gotten worse in this country. But around here, it's even more sharp. And a few journalists have wanted to cover that story. And each time, they are told the same thing. And it's that if you even mention suicide in any media whatsoever, the suicide rate goes up. Now, that's a sad fact. It is true that that tends to happen. Like, if you talk about suicide of young male men, immediately after discussing it, the amount of suicides of young male men will increase, sadly. But that's not a reason to ignore the problem. If anything, that's a reason we need to urgently address this problem. And if the only way that we get things urgently addressed is by drawing attention to them, and so we catch the government with its pants down, well, what else are we meant to do? You know, it's a rock and a hard place. But that's it. But they all, you know, they all think at the time they're guilty, basically, into not doing it. And I've had the same issue here myself. It was like recently I did some radio stuff. I did LBC. And I actually just lost it for a while. And I was, well, you know, if you really wanted to fix things, here's what you do. And I went into a bit of a diatribe at that point, talking about people being priced out of London and everything. And afterwards, I was contacted by people in this area and outside who were telling me, like, you can't talk like that. That's very irresponsible of you to speak in that fashion or in a broadcast. How dare you do that? And the gist of it was, is that you will anger people so much that they may riot. So it would be my fault that they rioted because I told them that something is happening. And not the fact that this thing is happening at all.
No, I understand. Well, what were you saying? Would you like to just relate it here too?
Because I did, as I said, I just kind of lost it at the time. But I was talking about things like, foreign ownership of properties and council tax, and the fact that you get second home discounts and things like that. Like, why should someone who can afford a second house get cheaper TV in that house? You know, you only have half the television in each of your households? You know, so why have you only got to pay one license in that manner? And there's so much like that we just get screwed over on at the most basic level.
Well, I mean, it's a shame Joe Strummer's not around, so I'm sure he'd have a lot to say about all this. Injustice that's behind a lot of this is because we've got the super rich seem to be absolutely in the driving seat. In fact, we seem to be sliding in this country towards a kind of fascistic system whereby big companies and the rich control everything. The people, as in Grenfell, just get ignored.
Well, I mean, the sad thing is that if you look throughout history, when the middle class start to get attacked in these situations, whether it was Nazi Germany or, you know, fascist Italy or even places like Argentina, what tends to happen is one thing is that once the middle class are targeted, they have a choice before them. They can either side with the people or they can side with the elite. And unfortunately, in all of those instances, people choose fascism over equality. You know, well, the people who matter, as it were, in a society. So the ones who have the resources to do something. You know, because look what happened in this country when we had lockdown. What was the first thing that happened after lockdown? Riots. It was like when we were actually given time to stop and think about everything that's happening around us, the first reaction of quite a lot of us was, screw this, let's tear it down. You know, why shouldn't, and when people are like, oh, why would you wreck your own town? That, you know, that's where you live. I can understand the reason quite well. We don't own any of it. We don't own any of it. We are allowed here at their pleasure.
Yeah, and they can eject you at any moment. In fact,
and they will eject you.
Yeah, constant looming threat of eviction over everyone.
That's it. You know, you can't stop. You know, I'd love to go and protest this weekend, but I'm knackered from working all week. You know, and yet, you know, the very thing that would maybe help you with it, and even what little protest there is now is being outlawed. You know, a Labour government were debating in the same week that they talk about learning lessons after Grenfell. They were talking about further restricting the rights to protest in this country. By, you know, by implementing the Tory policy that fell down just before the election. The one where, like, it bans things like wearing face masks at protests and will make a specific offence of climbing on war memorials during protests.
Well, do you think maybe it's going to take riots, serious riots in London, to actually get any change?
I think, unfortunately, the way that our government and political systems have gone now, it's the squeaky hinge that gets the oil. So it is only with scrutiny that you get anything done whatsoever in this country. Because I was quite, that was why I was so ruthless about using it, and I was so adamant with people in this area. Immediately after the fire, it's like, no, we have to get concessions now, and we get them solidified now. You know, and then they did the usual thing where they'll buy off certain groups of people in the area, or isolate groups from others, or turn them against each other and everything. But I was still resolute about things, and I still am now. I mean, as I said, I was head of insurance and risk at Brent Council. I'm just about to do claims for like 100-odd residents down there. They all have to do them on an individual basis because I'm not a solicitor. You see, yet another barrier. And Mackenzie friends aren't allowed to do legal paperwork for other people. Either only qualified legal professionals can do that. You see, and again, it's another barrier of entry. You know, I've dealt with loads of solicitors in my time up at Brent. There were times where I would go to court on a, if it was a Friday afternoon, it was, you know, it was a case I could see, oh, this is easy. I would go and defend it in court rather than pay for a solicitor. Because it was just easy to do. When it was a pavement trip claim, you know, the very prescribed law. Either you're liable or you're not. That's it. It's very easy to interpret whether you are or not. And yet, you know, solicitors would always try it because they'd assume that councils would pay you. And a lot of them would. If it was a case of paying someone, you know, 1,500 quid in total for a pavement trip, but it's going to cost you £4,000 to defend it. And even if you win, then you won't get that back from the other side. Now, why wouldn't you do it? You see, and people game the system like that all the time, but the only thing that we ever hear about is benefit fraud. And even if there was benefit fraud, I think it represents at most £8 billion of the current welfare budget of over £130 billion. And the eight, and to give you another idea, in 2019 it was only £2 billion. So what event could have happened in 2020 that led to a massive spike in benefit fraud that's still being identified?
Well,
today?
I mean, there was a massive fraud in the government loans as well. But anyway, Joe, well,
that's
the
point I'm making there is exactly like you touched on it there as well. It's like, look, it was their action deliberately, this accelerationism that you say. It was their action that led to this. They were so terrified of voters actually being jobless during COVID that all of a sudden, I dealt with the universal credit system before the fire, before lockdown happened. I dealt with it before that. It was an awful system. I remember people coming to me because I'm quite good with IT, and 2.5 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours would be like that, trying to fill up one person's form for universal credit. And yet one weekend, in March, in 2020, all of a sudden, that one weekend, they fixed the whole system. And they also fixed the glitch it had, where if the month ended on a bank holiday Monday, you didn't get paid that month. You would be paid double the following month. And they were taken to court several times by disability advocacy groups to say that this was fundamentally breaching the Equality Act, because it unfairly penalised people who had accessibility issues. And they were told, oh no, it's impossible for us to change this. You know, so you might have issues with paying your carers and things like that, but tough. They'll just have to wait till the following month. And they spent millions in court saying they couldn't do that.
ridiculous.
And just all of a sudden, over one weekend, all those problems were fixed. And like, yeah, ours is the stuff.
Well, it just shows you, with the right words in the right place, this cannot... Anyway, if people are interested in following what's going on with the Grenfell community, fighting back against the system still, it's like a kind of thing of ongoing abuse, not only murder of 72 people, but now a system which is trying to gaslight, sideline, etc. Where's the best place for people to hook up and follow what you're up to?
I mean, if you want to follow us, justiceforgrenfell.org, or you can follow me on Twitter. I refuse to call it anything else. It's Twitter. And I'm on Blue Sky with the same name, Jodafone UK. So Jodafone UK.
Okay.
So you can follow us there. But what I would say to people is, like, is support for other communities and things is brilliant. But the biggest thing you can do is get involved in your own one. You know, councillors have a lot of power. And if one thing that the politicians in Westminster do is they use local government as a weather vane. And that's why they're crapping themselves at the minute about reform, because they've got so many councillors. If you could do that in even one area where you can get in an independent who is in on a particular issue that the main parties are opposing in your area, that gets you the kind of media focus that we don't get in general. And sunlight is the best disinfectant. When these things are exposed, they all run like cockroaches. You know, the chief executive of the post office wasn't in tears when she found out that Horizon was actually causing people to be sent to prison erroneously and ruining their lives. She didn't cry at that point, but she cried in the inquiry when she was caught, didn't she?
Yes.
And that's how they're always going to be with them. It's transactional. Don't ever forget that. So unfortunately, we have to transact in that system for now. So
we
that's
do.
What I can say to people. Yeah. Get involved locally. Don't let them do to us what they did to you. You know, don't let them do to you what they did to us around here. We were isolated and ignored. Don't let them isolate and ignore you.
All right. Joe Delaney, thanks very much for joining us once more.
Thank you.